discounts in a time of inflation, a look at the global housing market, and what can we learn about our response to disasters from a novelist. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Baltimore, I'm Amy Scott in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Thursday, November 24th. Good to have you with us. What a difference a year can make in the retail economy. Last Thanksgiving, supply chains were congested. There were almost 60 container ships backed up at the ports of LA and Long Beach, and retailers had trouble stocking up to meet demand. Well, today, port traffic is moving fine, and retailers have too much inventory. We're going to dwell on that last point a bit, because this is a big holiday shopping weekend, after all. We've been hearing for a while about how stores are offering steep discounts to try to reduce some of the stockpile they built up during the pandemic. But figuring out how much to mark down a product can be tricky. Marketplace's Justin Ho has that story.
Markdowns aren't exactly ideal for retailers. Discounts hurt profit margins at a time when retailers' costs are rising. And if they cut prices too often, consumers might stop buying at regular prices, says Christina Boney at Moody's.
You don't want to train your customer to continually expect promotions.
Retailers can prevent that by offering promotions that only happen, say, once a year, like a Black Friday sale. Barbara Kahn is a professor of marketing at the Wharton School.
That's one way to clear out inventory and reduce price, but it does seem like it's not the real price. It's only here for a special period of time.
But if those discounts are too steep, or if they stick around for too long, Kahn says consumers might start questioning a brand's value.
In the past, like in the recession of 2009, when luxury brands did deep discounts because they mispredicted their holiday sales there, that took them a long time to bring back the value to the brand.
And if one retailer offers a discount, others might feel the need to match that price. Sucharita Kadali, a retail analyst at Forrester Research, says retailers might then go to the brand manufacturers and start demanding that they charge lower prices.
Saying, hey, you're allowing, you know, kind of this type of crazy pricing to happen, so you need to give us lower prices so we can, you know, at least break even or make a profit.
Kadali says manufacturers can try to prevent this from happening with minimum price agreements. These are common in high-end electronics, like phones or TVs, but less so with cheaper goods you might find at a big box store.
It's very hard when you're a mass consumer packaged goods brand that sells toothpaste to be able to do that because you just need as much distribution as you can get.
Kadali says most manufacturers would have a hard time enforcing a minimum price. That means their margins are likely to take a hit as well if retailers keep discounting products into next year. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
On Wall Street, U.S. markets were closed for the holiday, but we'll have some numbers for you when we get there. Another thing that's changed a lot in the past year, mortgage rates. They've more than doubled to just north of 6.5% right now for a 30-year fixed. Spare a thought for anyone trying to buy a house right now. Existing home sales are down 28% since last year, according to the National Association of Realtors. The thing is, ours is not the only country battling high inflation. Central banks in Canada, Latin America, and Western Europe are also raising interest rates. Marketplace's Matt Levin checks in now on the housing vibe in some other parts of the world.
For the last two decades, the Canadian housing market has boomed. A home in Toronto or Vancouver is at least as pricey as New York or San Francisco. And since the pandemic, prices in some markets soared more than 50%. Tony Stilo with Oxford Economics says a correction is coming.
We're looking for a 30% contraction in house prices across the country. It's already well underway.
The Bank of Canada has raised interest rates pretty much in lockstep with the Fed. But unlike the 30-year fixed in the U.S., Canadian mortgages lock in interest rates only 5 years at a time. And variable rate mortgages are very popular in Canada. As interest rates rise, Stilo says Canadian homeowners are going to feel the pinch more directly than their American neighbors. He's predicting a moderate recession.
We think that the economy is that much more sensitive to these hikes in interest rates.
The European Central Bank is also raising rates, which means the hottest housing markets there are also starting to cool. Nicolas Veron is an economist at the Peterson Institute for International Economics.
In Nordic Europe and parts of Germany, in some parts of the French market, we see a downturn.
But Veron says while monetary policy is slowing demand, immigration can be a counterweight. For example,
a number of places in Germany are getting a lot of immigrants. When lots of people enter the country and want a place to live, that stimulates demand for housing.
Immigration and remote work are also helping to buoy the housing market in some parts of Mexico. Maricela Perez with the Mexican Association of Real Estate Professionals.
Cities like Monterrey or Reynosa or Tampico, cities are close to the border, and all these people who live in the United States interested in buying here in Mexico.
Perea says Mexicans are increasingly interested in renting versus buying. Mexico's central bank recently raised its benchmark interest rate to 10%. I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
In this season of the Marketplace podcast, How We Survive, we're focusing on one place, Miami, because Miami and the rest of South Florida are in a unique spot when it comes to climate change. There's enormous wealth and severe poverty, a huge mix of cultures, and miles of coastline already facing increased flooding and more severe storms. Sometimes to understand our reality, it helps to turn to fiction. So I talked to Bruce Holsinger. He's a novelist with a new book out called The Displacements. It imagines what might happen if a Category 6 hurricane, a level that doesn't even exist yet, hits Miami head-on, displacing millions of people. How would society cope with such a massive disaster? And what struck me about Bruce's book was how very real it felt.
I wanted to build this world in the novel that would capture some of the emotional tenor of our moment. It's not an apocalyptic novel. It's set in the very near future. You could even say in the present. And it imagines that this aftermath of the world's first Category 6 hurricane and its effects on this family. It explores issues of downward mobility and precarity and a lot of themes that are wrapped up into our contemporary discussions of climate change. Now, setting it in Miami, we take it for granted. It's a truism that climate change has a disproportionate effect on the world's poor, on people of color, disadvantaged communities. And that's true, but it also is having an increasingly powerful and disastrous effect on more affluent populations. And you can't get much more affluent than in Miami and South Florida.
And I'm wondering if you can kind of paint a scene for us of what Miami would look like after a Category 6 hurricane. Your characters are displaced, so we don't really go back to Miami to see. I suppose that's a spoiler. I shouldn't say that for people who want to read the book.
Well, no, and it's okay.
But what do you imagine Miami looking like after such devastation?
Yeah, well, without giving a spoiler, I will say that at least you see some of the characters coming back at the very end. We have a scene where one of the characters recounts going back to where this house was. And what's going on now is restoration of dunes and the coast, where once there was a multi-million dollar gated community built out on artificial islands in Biscayne Bay. There's now shoreland restoration going on. I mean, the novel imagines Miami Beach at the end as really just a bunch of husks of buildings. And that, you know, if a Dorian-like hurricane lingered over Miami Beach, that's pretty much what you'd have, because some of the wind speed protections of even some of the newer buildings only go up to 175 or 200. So, you know, you just imagine what a city so wealthy, so built up would look like. It's the stuff of nightmares.
You talked about this a little bit, but reading it, I was struck by how real and how current it feels. And a lot of the references are very recent. Wildfires and hurricanes and flooding events that we've had, the pandemic, of course. What year do you imagine this taking place, and why did you want it to be to feel like the present?
Well, it could be. I mean, the way I was describing it when it first came out, when I would do readings, I would say this book could be taking place next month. It could be taking place next year. It could be taking place in 10 years. So I leave the exact timeline just a little bit squishy, but the very, very near future is how I would describe it. And I wanted to do that because I wanted it to be about our political situation, our often disastrous responses to disasters on federal, state, and local levels. But I also wanted it to be about the opioid crisis. And I wanted it to be about race and class and downward mobility.
What was interesting to you about this idea of downward mobility?
What was interesting about it?
Well, I mean, I think it's naturally interesting, but why were you drawn to that idea of downward mobility?
There's a wonderful book I read that you probably know, Rebecca Solnit, A Paradise Built in Hell, which is about how communities respond to the aftermath of catastrophe and how often the bonds that people form in the immediate aftermath of a disaster can create these new kind of provisional temporary communities. And I imagine the mega shelters in the novel as those sorts of communities, you know, people finding sources of resilience among themselves and building a new home with thousands of people unfamiliar to them. And that's a very plausible and accurate way of thinking about the aftermath of catastrophe. But there's another story, too, and it's about loss, the loss of home, the loss of family, the loss of income and employment, the loss of medications, and you know, how do you get your medications in a mega shelter? Maybe you don't even have insurance anymore. And that is something that poor people experience all the time, whereas you know, affluent people don't often have a way of grasping the extent of those kinds of problems for much of the nation's population. So those are some of the ways that I was thinking about that problem of downward mobility.
As we've been reporting this season, we came across the concept of climate change as a threat multiplier, you know, something the military talks about with regard to national security. But really, it's a helpful way to describe all the ways that social problems are amplified and worsened by climate change. And that really runs throughout your book. I mean, racism, classism, addiction, toxic masculinity, all these things are amplified by what these folks are going through. Can you talk about how you think of that idea of kind of a threat multiplier?
Yeah, you know, I didn't have that phrase in my head when I was writing the book, but that's exactly where I end up. And you know, there was a study that I read about Hurricane Harvey and the spike in opioid use and abuse in the months and years following that. And it can have a very, very long tail, you know, and those effects can last for years. So the loss of security, of income, of home, of neighbors, of family, those can just spike drug abuse. And, you know, because people just don't have anywhere to turn. They're in so many different kinds of pain. So I was thinking about it that way. I was also thinking about the, you know, on the issue of race and racism, the mega shelter that I portray in the book. So climate change there and the way that the internally displaced people, the way that they have to live now, it's a force multiplier for racial difference and racial strife and overt acts of racism. So yeah, I think that's a perfect way to describe how climate change functions in the novel. And in some ways, you could say that all novels try to find a force multiplier, right? That's really what plotting is, now that I think about it. It's some ways of giving your characters, your protagonist, more and more obstacles to overcome. And the more, you know, threat multipliers that you can find, the more plot points you have, I suppose.
Bruce Holsinger is author of The Displacements. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
This week's episode of How We Survive is all about you. We answer listener questions about flood insurance, where it's safe to live, and whether to rent or buy in the age of climate change. You can hear the episode at marketplace.org or on your favorite podcast platform. Coming up.
So I decided to make a prototype wig for my horse.
I'm all ears, but first, let's do the numbers. Markets in the U.S. are closed today for the Thanksgiving holiday. So how about some travel numbers? The TSA reports that about 2.4 million people passed through airport checkpoints yesterday, traditionally the biggest day of the year for travel. That's around 143,000 more than last year. And here's your turkey-related number, 30,000 to 35,000. That's wildlife officials' estimate of how many wild turkeys are currently living in Massachusetts. It's pretty remarkable when you consider that for about 120 years, there were zero. And now one of those wild turkeys is even famous, or rather notorious. Kevin, a male turkey in the Boston suburb of Woburn, has led a gang of birds that have pecked, kicked, and stalked residents in their cars for months. You are listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Amy Scott. Discounts, as Justin told us earlier, are one part of the retail picture going into the holiday season. People seem to still be shopping, even without them. Last week, we told you that retail sales grew by 1.3% from September to October. That's not adjusted for inflation. One category in particular, home furnishings, was up too. One of the most popular furniture styles, if you spend any time on Pinterest or apartment therapy, is mid-century modern. And now a famous example of that style is getting the green treatment. The plastic shell Eames chair is one of the latest classic American products to be made from recycled materials. From Durham, North Carolina, Cole Del Charco reports.
Charles and Ray Eames designed many different chairs that are still popular today. An iconic lounge chair, and also a molded plastic side chair for a dining table or desk. The molded side chair was featured at the Museum of Modern Art's International Low-Cost Furniture Design Competition in 1950. Charles Eames was interviewed about it on NBC a few years later.
In the case of the plastic chairs, the object was to take a material which was a high-performance material developed during the war and try to make it available to householders at non-military prices.
And it's very practical, is it?
Well, they made shock helmets out of it. Uh-huh. That should be pretty good.
After submitting to the competition, the designers worked with furniture distribution company Herman Miller to market the chair. For decades, it was sold to high-end interior designers, businesses, and schools. The chairs and many spin-offs and replicas are still selling briskly today. Ben Watson is the president of Herman Miller.
Both our design partners, Charles and Ray Eames, were committed to constant improvement, whether that was the first chairs in fiberglass, making those chairs out of bent wire a little bit later, constantly dreaming of making them out of molded plywood. Technology wasn't available to ultimately do that until after they had passed away.
Years ago, the company stopped producing the chair with fiberglass. The CDC says working with the synthetic fiber made from tiny glass particles can harm the eyes, skin, and lungs. So in 2006, Herman Miller reissued the shell chair using a new plastic. And now, another change. The company is making the molded plastic chairs from entirely post-industrial recycled plastic. Watson says using recycled materials fits the company's values and will help it achieve sustainability goals by 2030.
Part of that is a commitment to using a minimum of 50% recycled content across our whole offer. That required us to look literally at every molecule of the products that we're making.
Using recycled materials in manufacturing isn't new. Other brands like Nike have been making products out of leftover factory scraps for years now. Reed Lifsett is a research scholar at Yale School of the Environment.
I would say there are a lot more companies that are engaged with the issue.
Lifsett says industrial manufacturers who use recycled materials are taking an important first step. The benefit, he says,
it arises from replacing virgin materials, and it matters what materials are being replaced.
In many ways, the Eames chairs were ahead of their time, not only as design icons, but as sustainable objects. You can still find original Eames shell chairs from back in the day for sale online. I'm Cole Del Charco for Marketplace.
Sticking with retail, there was a story that went kind of viral a couple weeks ago about sneakers for horses. One Kentucky-based entrepreneur makes custom Air Jordans, Yeezys, and other sneakerhead favorites for around $1,200 per hoof. But shoes aren't the only equine apparel opportunity out there. Here's the next installment of our series, My Economy.
My name is Chanel Rhodes, and I am an equestrian entrepreneur. I make synthetic, easy-to-install wicks for horses. I've always been obsessed with horses ever since I was a little girl. I asked my mother, do black people ride horses? Because I didn't know. I'd never seen any on TV, so I didn't think that that was a thing that we did. And she said, you can do whatever you want to do. And I told her that I wanted to ride horses, and she said, okay. She's a single parent. She worked very hard to put me into lessons. And now I have a paint horse and an off-the-track thoroughbred. I wanted to contribute something creative to Black History Month back in 2019. So I decided to make a prototype wig for my horse. The first wig that I made, Lady, actually matched her mane. But it was poofy and fluffy. So I called it Afrocentric Pony. So we both had matching pompadours, we both had poofy hair, and we both had fros, horse fro. My friends from Young Black Equestrians were like, you should really make this into a business. Newsflash out there, not all horses have perfect hair. So they already make extensions for horses out there. That already exists. That's already an industry, but they usually use real horse hair from horses that have passed away. I didn't want to do that. I wanted to use some cheaper materials so it doesn't have to be a $600 piece of, you know, hair. And I wanted to offer something that comes in not just natural colors, but a wide variety of colors. I want to see some horses out there with rainbow manes. I kid you not, I probably cranked out about 40 to 50 some odd prototypes. My manes, they start out at 170, and depending on what color you want, they can go up to about, I think I have them up to about 225 or something like that. When you're trying to build something, there's always going to be some sort of obstacle that you have to overcome. I live in a small one-bedroom apartment in Southern California, and my horse is 30 miles away. Getting there and having my prototype fail 40 to 50 times is pretty nerve-wracking. But I had little girls looking at me. See, this is the thing that gets me all the time. I had parents in my inbox on Facebook sending me messages saying, my little girl wants to be like you. First of all, when I was a kid, I didn't even want to be like me. And, you know, it's still not easy. And I'm still at the beginning of my journey. And I'm still working on propelling myself forward and growing as a person, but I would never imagine myself here.
That was the lovely Chanel Rhodes in Long Beach, California. I know it's a tough act to follow, but hey, we need your help to make this series work. Please tell us about your economy at marketplace.org. The This final note on the way out. For some, tomorrow's a big shopping day, but for a lot of workers at Amazon warehouses, Black Friday is expected to be a day of protest. The Make Amazon Pay campaign, led by an international coalition of labor unions, is calling for better wages and conditions for warehouse workers. Bloomberg reports thousands of Amazon employees in about 40 countries are expected to participate in protests and walkouts, including in the U.S., U.K., India, Japan, and much of Europe. An Amazon spokesman told Bloomberg, "While we are not perfect in any area, we do take our role and our impact very seriously." Earlier this month, the company said it's cutting about 10,000 jobs ahead of a possible recession. Okay, we got to go, but here's your moment of economic context on this Thanksgiving Day. Coming back to those retail discounts, if you're in the market for toys this holiday season, Adobe Analytics says this is your moment. Discounts on toys are at record highs of 30% off the listed price in the first 3 weeks of this month. And that's helped push online toy sales up 172% from last month. Amir Bibawi, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Rick Carr, Diantha Parker, Amanda Peacher, and Stephanie Seek are the Marketplace editing staff. I'm Amy Scott. We will see you tomorrow. This is APM.